Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we're visiting Techland with the HBO show Silicon Valley. And in our second segment, we'll bring you a conversation about some real burgers based on and inspired by some cartoon burgers. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. StoryCorps travels the country collecting the wit, wisdom, and poetry in the stories of everyday people. The StoryCorps podcast showcases these unscripted stories about real life. Listen in and discover meaning in the words of someone you might not notice walking down the street. Find the StoryCorps podcast now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We're all about tech dudes and great burgers this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us from New York, a new addition to our rotation of fourth chairs, Danielle Henderson. Danielle, what do you do up there?
Hey guys, I am a TV writer and pop culture critic.
That's right, and tell everybody some of the places that you've written for. It's a pretty impressive list.
I've written for The Guardian, for The New York Times, for Elle, Cosmopolitan.
You were with Rookie for a while.
I was with Rookie. I was a story editor for Rookie for a long time. I love that.
It's very, very cool. Yeah, we're so glad that you could join us. And Danielle is one of the people who responded when we said, who wants to talk about Silicon Valley? So this past Sunday marked the return of Silicon Valley, which is an HBO comedy focusing on the rises and mostly falls of a tech startup. The show is created by Mike Judge and John Altshuler and Dave Krinsky. It stars Thomas Middleditch, T.J. Miller, Martin Starr, Kumail Nanjiani, Zach Woods, lots of other people. The basic premise of the show, if you don't know it, is that Richard, who is played by Middleditch, is a kind of a tech guy who invents a better way of compressing files, which sounds like the least sexy premise for a comedy, maybe ever. And then, of course, you know, he gets involved with their Google equivalent, which is right. Called Hooli. And everything sort of goes from there. He starts the company. I don't know. He does have quite a lot of tech adventures. Danielle, what is your basic bottom line on Silicon Valley?
It is one of the best, most uncomfortable shows I've ever watched.
Yeah.
I think it excels at making a very staid topic quite interesting from
right?
the inside.
Yeah.
I don't really know anyone in Silicon Valley, but I've heard the stories of Silicon Valley. And mm-hmm. I think that, Mike Judge might not be the best insider, but he certainly is the best and most acerbic person to kind of bring those stories to life.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. I think it's a very fair take. How about you, Glenn?
I love it. It's basically a comedy of manners, but it's a comedy of nerdy manners.
Yeah.
It lives in this space of frustration. In a lot of the stuff that Mike Judge and those two other guys have done, Office Space, King of the Hill, Idiocracy, Extract, Silicon Valley, there's a through line where we have a main character who is inflexible to some degree, mm-hmm. who holds onto a certain set of values or something, and the people around him or her, invariably him, don't hold those same values. And that frustration that erupts from that is this sense of being fecklessness. These dudes have no discernible feck at all.
Right.
And that frustration is where this comedy lives. And mm-hmm. it's a very of-the-moment kind of thing. Because the reason it's so relatable is because everybody in their head feels like they're right.
Right.
The world around them is wrong.
Right.
And if people would just listen, then everything would go okay. And over again, that's what plays out.
Yeah. Stephen, you had not watched this until relatively recently. Is that right?
Yeah. I managed to binge almost the entire series thus far in the span of about 24 hours. And first of all, I'm having a lot of the same reactions that you guys are. It's an enormous amount of fun. The characters are increasingly well drawn. Part of what I love about it is, you know, when we talk about the relatability, Danielle said, you know, like, I don't know people in Silicon Valley. I don't know people in Silicon Valley. But they really managed to paint a picture that overlays any kind of push and pull between a creative enterprise and a corporate mm-hmm. enterprise, and the difference between having a great idea and running a great business. Mm-hmm. And it is really one of the central conflicts of the show is like this central kid has this very boring but very potentially lucrative
and
idea.
And very creative in its own way. It's boring.
Right.
It's boring as a thing to think about in terms of file compression, but it's an incredibly creative and innovative idea.
Right. Explained in a hilariously raunchy way.
Yes.
At one point. It's really no different from, like, if you are a musician and you don't know how to distribute your music, or mm-hmm. you want to start a media company, but you don't have the connections to do that.
Yeah.
Like, that push and pull between ability to get a business off the ground and, like, having a great idea is universal to anyone, really, in any kind of business pursuit. And so you have a lot of very specific satire of the kind of product names that come up, you know, from ones like Hooli that are obviously supposed to map over Google, to like bad app ideas that are constantly coming up. There's a lot of opportunity to mine comedy there, but it still feels relatable even if you're not in the tech world.
Yeah, well, and I think the apps that they come up with that are terrible, stupid app ideas on Silicon Valley, I mean, I don't think they've ever had anything that's any sillier than Yo was.
Which they actually make fun of at one point.
The app that just said Yo. Like, I don't think any of the stuff that they have, if Yo can be real, then right. most of the stuff that they have can be real. I was interested in how you responded to it, Stephen, as somebody who binged a bunch of it, because if I have a reservation about it, I think it plays well as a show that I tend to only watch three or four of at a time at the most, because I do think its rhythms tend to repeat.
Yeah.
There is a
I definitely noticed that.
There is a poor, you know, Richard gets his company going and it seems like he's going to have a big victory.
All of his victories
are pyrrhic. Like, that's the only kind of victory that
they pause occasionally to rapidly inflate the balloon and then spend like 8 episodes
right.
slowly deflating it.
Right. No, that's true. Danielle, what about this is sort of the most kind of relatable element for you?
I was thinking a lot about, there's something about this show where it's got this real Geeks Inherit the Earth quality, but what I love about the show and what I think makes it relatable is that it doesn't make the world better. So
yeah.
we have these meek and geeky people inheriting, a large part of our financial structure and what's been the basis of the future, so to speak, you know, through you know, all the technological advances and everything that they're working on. But it doesn't make their lives better, and it doesn't really seem to make the world better. There's a lot of failing upwards on this show.
Oh, yes.
I feel like that somehow rings true in my own life and what I've seen demonstrated through other people and bosses that I may have had.
Well, let's talk about that specifically.
Yeah. No. I think Not naming any names.
Who is your worst boss, Danielle? Let's talk about that. Who's the worst person from whom you still request freelance assignments?
Strangely, no one currently. It's funny how that works.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the things that I find interesting about the show, too, is that the bosses on the show, it's relatable to, like, any bosses, but at the same time, they do have a specific quality, which is that unlike, for example, if you're in, like, literary world or you're in even music world, you have people, if you're a creative, who believe that they have a kind of legacy of creativity that often goes back. You know, often there's an idea that you're trying to maintain the standards of some old art and some old kind of some form that has been around for a very long time. I think one of the things that's part of the guys who run the tech companies on this show is that kind of the only expertise they have is very, very difficult to actually substantiate.
Yeah.
Any expertise, there's a, in the new season, they bring in Stephen Tobolowsky, who plays
wonderful.
He is wonderful. He's always wonderful.
I always love him.
And he comes in and plays kind of a CEO for hire who's going to come in and sort of take over running Pied Piper day to day. But you start to look at what he's actually done, and there's this idea, oh, he's got this amazing record. But then you start to look at, well, what's he actually done? And it always comes down to sort of, well, he ran this company and then it sold for a lot of money. It's
right.
always just, there's not a lot of there. And that's what makes it so interesting that Richard, who actually is capable of creating something,
right.
is stuck in that world with those guys. Glenn, I'm sorry, you look like you...
No, but two of the main bosses on the show are Gavin, who runs Hooli, yeah. and Russ Hanneman, who is the guy who takes over Pied Piper. I miss that character. It's only been one episode
yeah.
of the third season, and I miss that character so much because
so much.
What they both have is confidence, And that's it. That's pretty much. And it's the opposite. Yeah. And Richard represents the opposite of confidence. Somebody who should be confident, and when he does get confident, it's always on the wrong cycle.
Like right. he's always goes off the rails.
It always goes off the rails because he doesn't know how to handle it, and he doesn't know how to handle people. And that so that dichotomy. There are two kinds of people in Silicon Valley. There are Richards and there are Gavins, and that feels real. That feels people who have gotten there because by virtue of just them being able to talk themselves into a place.
And the Richards of Silicon Valley seem to be a little bit petulant. They're almost in this kind of stunted childhood emotional reaction. So in this episode, in the premiere, he is flailing wildly at everyone around him who doesn't immediately go along with his idea of where his company should go. And he's not necessarily wrong. It's just the way that he chooses to express himself reminds me of, you know, like my niece or my goddaughter who just kind of flail and thrash and scream until somebody gives them a cookie to calm them down.
Right.
And I appreciate that Matt Ross, who plays Gavin Belson, he was on Big Love. He played Albie Jr. in Big Love. And he brings a little bit of that kind of sociopathic, psychopathic vibe with him.
He sure does.
As the CEO of Hooli.
He sure
and
does.
Even this week, I just thought it was amazing that one of the funnier parts of this to me was his guru was sitting in the audience with a big gulp when he was announcing the end of the Nucleus Project and how the two men turned to each other and said, oh my gosh, he's so brave when he said, you know, this is really hard for me to fire this entire team. Like, he's such a sociopath at heart. And it's amazing to watch him work.
He really is.
Their work with the topmost billionaires and the way they give shape to those characters. Watching mainlining the first like 16 episodes of this show or whatever, I felt viscerally the pain of losing Christopher Evan Welch, who plays Peter Gregory in the first season. And the actor who played him died after they had taped 5 episodes. And they disappear the character a little bit at the end of that first season. They kind of just show, you know, video footage of him but largely keep him away. And to me, he is so funny.
Yeah.
And that character is instantly so interesting and weird.
And he's a billionaire, but a different kind from Gavin.
Right. He's not a hard charging billionaire. He's kind of, there's some Bill Gates DNA in there, but it's more awkward, but still like incredibly self-congratulatory at the same time. Yeah. Like both of the competing billionaires have this kind of like this benevolent guru persona about them. Yeah. Once they lose him and they have to explain his death at the beginning of season 2, that side of things feels rudderless for a while. Mm-hmm. It felt like they had so many places to go with that character, and losing that character so early in that series' run was such a tragedy.
There are times when I'm not 100% sure what it's ultimately about. It seems to be about this Sisyphean struggle itself. And so much of the time on this show, so much of the time is just spent in the house, which is, you know, Richard is in this incubator, is working out of this incubator owned by
T.J. Miller.
The guy played by T.J. Miller, who...
Ehrlich Bachman,
who had... who won company Aviato.
Oh, my God, the references to Aviato.
And now has this incubator where ultimately he winds up working with Jared, played by Zach Woods, who's amazing.
Yes.
And Dinesh and Guilfoyle, played by Kumail Nanjiani and Martin Starr. And you spend so much time just in that house with those dudes. This is probably the right place to remind people that Kumail's a little bit of a friend of the show.
Sure.
Did a lovely X-Files small batch with us. So you can take everything we say about how funny he is with a grain of salt.
We were talking about how funny that guy was.
No, we were.
Before we ever...
That's sort of how one of the ways that he became a friend of the show. But I think particularly he and Martin Starr are so funny. That dynamic is so...
I love them.
They're so weird. I could just watch them. They come up with an acronym in the premiere of the new season that is so necessary. And the minute that you hear it, you think, I've needed this all my life.
Yes.
I've needed it for conversations my whole life. And that is one of the things the show is really good at, in the way that people always said Seinfeld was, or Sex and the City was, at putting its finger on something that you just felt like, I've been waiting for someone to put a name to this, yeah, or or put some structure around this for a gazillion years, and now here, you know, it probably is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the show is really, as Danielle mentioned, the show is really about what happens when nerds get the thing that they desperately want, but they pretend they don't, which is the acceptance of the mainstream. Yeah. Once they get it, they don't know what to do with it, and things fall apart and they lash out. But we have to talk about the line-by-line writing. There is a line that Jared says, "You're the belle of the ball, and all these guys are swains who are wanting a glimpse of ankle." It's such a weird, incredibly well-delivered line.
Yeah. He is so good.
There is a run that T.J. Miller has, and he's had a couple over the course of the show's run, of just doing old guy insults.
Yeah.
And
that was my favorite.
The insults themselves are fine. The delivery, the way he expands into it.
He's so proud of himself.
I think my favorite was deviled eggs as an entree.
Oh, gosh, I am normally not big into like the pothead as a comedic trope, but he is such a specific kind of pothead that the fact that he is constantly smoking, like every time you see him, does not grate on me the way it does with some characters. Like,
it's almost
incidental. Yeah, it is almost incidental. He's a different sort of pothead. I will say, I wish that they were more able to integrate more women into this cast.
I think they clearly try.
There are a couple who are associated with kind of the corporate side of this, but really none who have lasted on the kind of side of Richard and his guys. And I understand that is partly a reflection of what the reality of these guys' lives might be like, and there is some fun that is had from time to time with their very isolation. But when I see a show where there's a bunch of really good comedy and it's almost entirely owned by dudes, I do notice it. It's not fatal to the show, but I do notice it, and I would love to see them find a way. Maybe.
They
what
try
do you think,
so
Danielle,
hard.
You think?
Like, they have Amanda Crew, who plays Monica, who worked for Peter Gregory and kind of has been has stayed on the show despite his absence through clever, creative business decisions.
Indeed.
She's one of these people that kind of acts with her eyes, like her eyes well up with tears, and she's not crying, but you know, she looks so sensitive all the time. And I think that she's a great foil to Suzanne Cryer's character of Lori Beam, who plays the new owner of Pied Piper. And she's mostly robotic. And I think that it's kind of fun and interesting that they can get these two different opposing types of women on the show who might very well be present in Silicon Valley.
Right.
But it also feels like that's all they're willing to do. They had that one coder last season who didn't last long and was always the butt of a joke and was always kind of a hyper tough woman. Like, she seemed to have to transcend all logic when it came to, you know, just being a person in the world and doing her job just to get through the day. And so it's interesting that they have these two women and these two great actresses who are able to portray them. I think that the Lori Beam character is so funny to me when she says things like, well, you can clearly see that I'm so emotional about this.
As between those two women, she certainly gets more comedy. You know, I would love to see them continue to try to, it's like I said, it's one of those things. It's just
Well, I don't want the underdog stuff to kind of trump the gender dynamics, which I think are equally important in that realm to discuss. And
I
went back and watched the first episode just because I wanted to kind of see how far the show had come.
Sure.
I forgot that it opened up with Kid Rock playing this very boring house party.
I wanted to
talk about the musician cameos on this show and how effective they have Kid Rock in the first episode. They have Flo Rida fairly early on, and they have Shakira. Or at least the music of Shakira.
Unreal.
The way of like bringing in these musicians to do like kind of lifeless performances that are ill received is a very, very funny twist on the guest musical performance.
and to a completely segregated room. Like, the women are on one side and the men are on the other.
No, it's true. And there is also, like, every episode of the show, when it goes to the credits, very often, like, you will have been watching these kind of somewhat ineffectual feeling dudes sit around, and then the credits will always slam to, like, a really hard charging.
There was an article about that in the Wall Street Journal this week.
Oh, cool.
Rudy Chung, the music supervisor, talked about the use of rap music and hardcore music in this geeky world.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he said something that I kind of agree with, two things actually. He said that the energy continues even when the image cuts to black, mm-hmm. which is true. And this week they used a song by DJ Shadow that they remixed this song from Run the Jewels yeah. that just came out 10 days ago, but the show had access 2 months ago.
Oh my gosh.
And then he also said, which again, I totally agree, that the characters seem vanilla, but as you get to know them, there's some street cred, though not literally. What these guys are trying to accomplish is pretty gangster. So I really appreciate that the music lends this heavy hand where the characters themselves cannot to explain a world that is seemingly lawless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley airs on Sunday nights on HBO. It just started its third season. It is already renewed for a fourth. We enjoy it. Give it a look. You can find it wherever you find your old HBO episodes. Now, when we come back for our B segment, Stephen was lucky enough recently to have a conversation with Lauren Bouchard, the creator of Bob's Burgers, about burgers. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to have that conversation coming up right after this.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from the Lagunitas Brewing Company. Popular belief has it that Lagunitas began on a kitchen stove in Northern California in 1993. From actually getting beers into bottles and onto the streets, Lagunitas looks to the future. From expanding the Petaluma Brewery to building a second in Chicago and soon a third in Azusa, California, to bringing its flagship IPA across the pond, Lagunitas could probably make good beer on the moon if needed. Because wherever you go, beer speaks, people mumble. More mumblings at Lagunitas.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Linda promised a burger-centric discussion in this segment, and I've got one right here. I'm here with Lauren Bouchard, the creator of the animated TV show Bob's Burgers. Now, for those who don't know the show, it's about a loving but somewhat luckless family, a dad, a mom, and their three kids, who run a struggling burger joint and otherwise muddle through life. Bob's Burgers just spun off a cookbook, which gave us the idea to sit down with Lauren and discuss not only hamburgers, but also Bob's Burgers itself. Lauren Bouchard, welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour.
My pleasure.
Now, Bob's Burgers is well into its sixth season, and we'll get to the show in a second, but I'm holding in my hand a brand new book called The Bob's Burgers Burger Book. And it's a cookbook based on those burger of the day puns behind the counter at Bob Belcher's burger restaurant. Basically, for those who haven't seen the show, in each episode of Bob's Burgers, you know, you have the burger of the day, like a pun in the background. It might be the Chevre Which Way But Loose Burger or the Don't You For Cheddar About Me Burger. And the puns are generally a little tortured. Am I representing this bit properly?
Yes. Sweaty. The sweatier the better.
So as the legend goes, and this is in the book, a blogger named Cole Bowden started a project called the Bob's Burgers Experiment, where he set about making each of the joke burgers. And this book is a collection of his recipes?
Yes. We were making the recipes purely as jokes, not as real burgers. We kept an eye on whether they sounded semi-believable. I mean, we rejected ones that weren't gonna fly. They just had to pass some sniff test in terms of being believable burgers, but we had no intention of actually making them. Obviously, just a reasonable sort of half-assed attempt at making them edible. That was our standard. And then this kid started making the burgers for real, and it was really exciting, and it was really one of those things where at first I didn't have any contact with him. I just checked in on his blog every once in a while to see if he was still doing it, because of course I would forgive him if he didn't, if he had given it up, either because he had bad results or because he just had a life and didn't want to continue to do it. I would have absolutely understood, but he didn't. He stayed with it. And so we were, you know, I don't know how many burgers in he was when he and I gently touched base over internet and email and just had a little bit of contact. And it was right around the time when we started thinking, geez, the possibilities of kind of a cookbook, you know, when the show reaches just a certain number of years in, you can crap out a bunch of products if you're so inclined. And we really didn't want to do that. We didn't want to put out a novelty cookbook that was just cashing in on the few people who might pick it up as an impulse purchase. If we were going to do it, we wanted to do it well. And so his blog became suddenly the potential heart of this thing, where all his work would be what we would base it around. And he himself was, you know, adding ingredients and inventing these things because all he knew from the blackboard on the show was the dopey name we'd given it. Yeah, yeah, the one ingredient that we'd managed to think of a joke for.
Well, it's funny. Reading it, the first thing I thought was, oh, my God, I'm actually going to learn something about how to make better hamburgers.
And, of course, that's the other thing is once you set about making one of these things, you immediately come up against the possibility that if you are irresponsible, someone could get sick and die. You know, I mean, this is red meat. You know, this is ground beef. You can't be cavalier about it. So the section on how to cook a hamburger includes, you know, me being suddenly very nervous about
it. Comes across.
Good.
Now, you mentioned in the intro that the joke burgers provide a window into Bob Belcher's mind, that he's actually a creative guy who's passionate about his art, which just happens to be making burgers. And it's interesting to me, like, how much of the tension and drama of the show comes from the intensity with which people care, whether they're adults or kids. I just found that interesting about the show. Like, everybody on that show is passionate.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's cheating a little bit. Obviously, we're drawing on our own experiences. We, meaning the writers, the actors, the artists, the designers. We're all those people. You know, there's this creative urge, which you can't quite understand. And if you're a kid and you're, you know, up in your room and you're drawing compulsively hour after hour and you just can't stop drawing, there's nothing knowable about it. You don't quite understand what you're going for or why you are in that, you know, eighth hour of drawing dragons or whatever it is that you're doing at that point. But for me, as I got older and I started wanting to tell stories, in a way, the characters that are most interesting to me are those people. It's like figuring that out about myself and about the people I work with, that urge to create and that passion, where it comes from and what it does for you. So it seems like, to me, a really fun and a great characteristic to give a character.
Well, and an obsessive character is an interesting character. I mean, Gene's desire to make music clearly drives so much of what he does, even though he is not yet good at it.
Yeah, that's me.
I think that's a lot of people. That was certainly me too. And you seem to have picked a cast of people who are good at going from deadpan to unhinged. I mean, starting from John Benjamin on down.
Yeah. The cast is the show in a lot of ways. I mean, we cast first and then wrote.
Mm.
This was the cast before I knew much more than There's a Family Who Has a Restaurant. They were the cast. And we changed the sex of the oldest child. Tina was going to be a boy named Daniel. But besides that, we didn't change the cast at all. This was who we knew we wanted to work with. And then you fit the characters to the people. I recommend it to anyone who's developing an animated TV show. Go ahead and find the people you want to work with and whose voices you like and whose comedic talents appeal to you, and then think about what character that would be best for them to play. You can do it the other way around. Of course, millions of projects have started with a conception of a character, and then you go out and audition or, you know, cast for who could play that character, but I think it's harder.
Interesting. I mean, that's funny, because I was interested. You have several men playing female characters. I mean, Dan Mintz, who plays Tina, you cast him to be Daniel and then decided he should be Tina?
Yes. The original 12 minutes that we produced for Fox were almost exactly the first 12 minutes of the pilot that aired on TV, with one significant difference. Dan Mintz was a 13-year-old boy named Daniel, and he sounded like he does now. The dialogue was exactly the same. We switched the sex, and we had to switch only one word,
wow,
which was balls.
One would imagine.
He says, my crotch is itchy. She says, my crotch is itchy in the opening scene. And that was the only language we had to change. The network had one thought. They were sort of picking at this possibility that maybe the oldest child wasn't differentiated enough. They use this word in Hollywood, which I kind of like, even though it has a little stink of Hollywoodism on it. But they say he wasn't popping. That character wasn't popping. The Louise character is popping. The Gene character is popping. And
sure,
then this Daniel kid,
well,
they didn't
louder.
Quite. Yeah, they're louder. And just what's his, like, thing? And I think on some level, we just lucked in to a great trick. I've heard this before, that writers can sometimes get stuck writing female characters. And one trick is to write it like it was a male character.
Hmm.
It's just a weakness of writers. It's not
right.
a weakness of any gender. It's just writers are unimaginative, like all of us. We fail sometimes to really find what's interesting about a person when we're trying to create them, and we got lucky. So we created the drawing of Tina, much as she looks now. We put some test dialogue in her mouth. You know, we just drew her on a blank screen with her little mouth moving with dialogue that we'd already shot for Daniel. And then we also used some stand-up from Dan Mintz.
Mm-hmm.
So we sent that to the network. We said, we think we've solved this Daniel problem. What do you think?
Wow.
And to their credit, they went for it. They said, yeah, that's a great answer to the question, how do you make the oldest child pop?
Huh. All right, the question I'm about to ask you is not a tough question. Bob's Burgers is a show that everyone in my house likes. I have a contrarian tween daughter who likes anime and horror movies. I have a teenage son who generally he's down for the stuff I like. I've got a girlfriend whose appetite for TV is pretty limited, but you know, pretty specific. It generally consists of walking by the TV and either approving or disapproving. And we all love Bob's Burgers. It is a show that all of us watch and enjoy. What is it about this show that makes it appeal? I mean, this really is like your campaign has the momentum of a runaway freight train. Why are you so popular? But like, what is it about this show that makes it appeal to that kind of broad cross-section of people?
It's a good question, and I don't totally know the answer, but I can take a few swings. I think that a family comedy, by definition, should be pretty damn universal. I mean, if you are a network and you call your project a family comedy, well, you know, you're pretty much that's a mission statement, right? You should have your kid characters, your female characters, your male characters, your parents, your grandparents, everybody theoretically should be fleshed out enough that a family can sit down and watch it together and see themselves.
Sure.
This is not always the case. Certainly there are shows about families that do not appeal to the whole family. There are shows about families that are inappropriate for the whole family.
Sure.
We think we all know what we're talking about there. but there is a nice challenge there laid out right away. If you're making a show about a family that is more or less intended to be watched by a family, then you had better bring your attention to each character and make sure that they're speaking to the audience, which is not to say if you're a kid and you're watching the show that you're only, you know, liking the kid characters and vice versa. You
right.
know, part of what's great about animation is we have adults playing kids.
Right.
So right away, when we started out, if no kid ever watched the show, I wouldn't have seen that as a failure. In fact, we weren't really making it for kids as young as I'm finding out now are watching it.
Yeah.
We have material in the show that's not quite right
sure.
for kids of a certain age, but they're watching and it's really chilling. Now, I'm having like a problem. I have young kids and they are just young enough that a lot of it goes over their head.
Sure.
But there is there's sort of a, you know, light danger now that when I go into preschool to do drop off, I'm going to get a parent who's going to say, my child was yelling at the top of their voice, I'm good at sex, you're bad at sex, I'm good at sex, you're bad at sex. And I want you to know that it was difficult for us.
I've definitely had the experience of having my kids laugh at certain jokes and she's like, why are you, wait, what? Why are you laughing?
Yeah.
But I do think like part of the secret recipe would seem to be that sort of in the equation, weirdness is greater than meanness. It's not a particularly mean show.
No, it's explicitly not a mean show. We have a group of people who for the most part do not respond to that kind of humor, or to the extent that we do, there's no urge to put it on screen. I think mean jokes sometimes can be very funny in a room, but there is something weird about putting a mean joke on television. I don't quite want to go and make any blanket statements. I don't want to take away anyone else's right to both make a show that's a little edgy and mean or to enjoy it. And I think I've enjoyed it. You know, well-made mean shows are still really
sure.
can be delicious. But for me, I'm always surprised when somebody wants to put a mean joke into a script or on the air. It seems like, geez, you want to put that out there? Like, is that what we're doing? It feels in a way like you have to really not care. And I guess I'm not that guy. I'm just a little more comfortable when our show really is explicitly trying not to be mean, which is not to say, you know, that characters aren't in conflict and there isn't edge. But yeah, you don't want to feel that the show itself is being mean about one of its characters.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, did you make a conscious decision along the way to let Bob win a little bit more often? When the show started out, he seemed so luckless. Mm. And over time, it feels like he gets a little, he gets a few more triumphs.
That's interesting. We made a conscious decision at the beginning. We wrote on a sticky note and put on the wall small victories.
Oh,
that was the goal. That was explicit. That was what we wanted to be doing in each episode, a little victory that felt sometimes even in the face of a bigger defeat. But if you could pull out that victory, you could say, well, you know what? This is what they needed at this moment. You know, the Burger War episode that was in the first season. I mean, all we wanted in the end was he had to renew his lease, obviously. Right. But more importantly, his landlord said, you're an artist.
Right.
Jimmy Pesto's just a businessman. You're an artist. And so those little victories were important to us. And of course, you know, being comedy writers, we're always trying to then cut the treacle, as they say. You don't want them to win too big. So you find little defeats, I guess, to go with it. You make a little defeat victory sandwich. And I suppose it's possible that over the seasons, we've modulated how those victories feel. But the goal is to always try to kind of give you both.
Nice.
Like life.
Like life itself. Is there a show Bible that says how each of the kids might one day turn out? Do you ever have that in mind?
I mean, not really. I mean, you want to leave that stuff a little loose. We can all have our own guesses and interpretations about that, and it's certainly an interesting conversation to have. I wouldn't want to set it down on paper and then accidentally make that the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting writing a show that takes place in the ever-present now. You know, it's a trick. You have to sort of pick and choose what you want to carry forward and kind of bring into the continuity, which we do. You know, the ice cream machine gets destroyed by a mechanical shark or almost destroyed. And then we decided, you know what, let's change that prop so it always bears the scars of the mechanical shark. But at the same time, they've had seven Christmases at the same age. They've all been the same age, but they've had seven. So it's there's a mathematical impossibility. And in a way, it makes you want to reject continuity and serialization and looking into the future. You have to kind of just live in this forever moment where Tina's 13, Jean's 11, and Louise is 9. The parents are in their mid-40s. And what is that like again? Part of it is just going back and saying, well, what is fun for a 9-year-old or an 11-year-old or a 13-year-old to be going through? And we've got theoretically endless possibilities, but you know, it does get a little harder. You do sort of start feeling the trail of shows behind you. And you say, well, we did do that. You know, we can't do that again. Her first kiss was, you know, was covered. But, you know, it's a great challenge. It's a good problem to have, as they say.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about you didn't want to spin out cheesy merchandise. You wanted to fan out the franchise in a very careful way. Is there any talk of a Bob's Burgers movie?
There's no talk of a Bob's Burgers movie. That would be an interesting thing to take on. I don't know what it would look like, but, if we came up with the right story, it would be really fun to do one. I don't think there's any interest in it. I mean, the fans would probably enjoy it, but I don't know if there would be enough. I don't know. I don't know how all those things work. Right now, anything at all, any shirt, sticker, any of those things that comes out and pleases the fans and pleases us, that's all. We're grateful for that. So I don't want to accidentally be the guy, you know, starts thinking about the movie. It's hard enough to do the few things that we've done. We were so lucky. I'll say this. Whatever the fans want, we'll try to deliver if we're lucky enough to still be doing this. We had the fans from the beginning. They were so good to us. They were so there for us. They made us feel, even when our ratings were, they were okay. We weren't sure if we were going to get picked up based on our ratings, but we were sure that we had a relationship with our fans right away. And so for me, everything that we're going to do in terms of merchandise or ancillary products, the comic book, the cookbook, all that stuff is basically just a long extended thank you that, you know, when we started making this show that we had people who gave us back, you know, all this love. That was so helpful and gratifying that now it's just, you know, we'll try to make cool stuff.
Nice. Lauren Bouchard, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
That's Lauren Bouchard, creator of Bob's Burgers and co-author of the Bob's Burgers Burger Book. When we come back, we'll get to our final and favorite segment of this and every episode, What's Making Us Happy This Week, so stick around.
A quick shout out to one of our sponsors who brings you this message, Target. If you haven't yet, you have to check out Made to Matter, handpicked by Target. There's a natural wool dryer ball from Baby Gannix that cuts drying time up to 25% and lasts for 1,000 loads. And Bitsy's Brain Food has a line of USDA organic crackers that have half a serving of veggies in each serving. And they're made in a nut-free bakery. Check out all the better-for-you products from Made to Matter at target.com/made-to-matter.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week. And let's face it, every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week? Take it away.
As everyone knows, last week was very difficult. We lost Prince. Linda, you and I did a small batch discussing it.
Yep.
And over the course of the day in which that news broke, I had a chance to sit down with Sam Sanders, the host of the NPR Politics podcast, for this experiment that we've been doing with Facebook Live, where we've been doing like little impromptu talk shows around the building. And we called it a talk show slash therapy session, and we'll throw up a link on the blog. But I just had a chance in the middle of all this chaos of covering Prince's death, including this show. I ended up doing 2 hours of The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah, you did.
Wearing a drab gray t-shirt because that's what I wore to work that day. But this respite in the middle of the day where Sam and I just sat on a couch and just talked about our Prince memories was, I found, very cathartic, very therapeutic. Sam is a wonderful, wonderful host. That Politics podcast is terrific.
It really is.
A very good dude and a good host.
A great guy. And I just loved working with him. And then when I had to run to talk to Wolf.
Right, sure.
As one does.
As you do.
They then swapped in Alicia Montgomery and Gene Demby from Code Switch and ended up talking, I think the whole piece is probably about 40 minutes. But there's just a lot of information and insight in there. I loved doing it. We're going to be doing more stuff with Facebook Live. Actually, just today, we're taping this on Monday, there was a discussion in the same spot of the new Beyonce project, Lemonade.
Yep.
It's just an interesting forum for these kind of long-form discussions of breaking news and entertainment and issues. So Facebook Live, we will see where we go with it.
Nice. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, bud?
Two things. A Twitter account, at past postcard, P-A-S-T, postcard, is exactly what it sounds like. You see the image on the front of the postcard. You see the writing on the back of the postcard, and that's it. And they've just found a lot of old postcards, and that's what you get. Just slips into your feed. And it's not like they found the funniest or the most well-written postcards. They're just random postcards, and it's based in the UK, so the postcard choice tends to reflect that. So you get all this language like, hope mum's doing okay, like all that stuff. The point of it is how mundane it is.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's this little smack of mystery because you're peeking into somebody else's life. And it's such a wonderful thing just to have kind of randomly pop up in your feed. So that's at past postcard. The other thing is a documentary series, 6 episodes, streaming on Netflix called Secrets of Great British Castles. Okay, now, I get it. It's not flashy. It's not what the kids love today. It's not Snapchatting. It's not face swapping. I get it. And as I sit there and I watch it, I can feel like a spiritual cardigan manifesting on my body. And I feel this need to watch CBS, you know, in real time. And in theory, it's no different from anything that you would watch, you know, when it's a Sunday afternoon and you kind of feel the work week closing in on you and you just want to spend that Sunday afternoon on the couch watching the History Channel. In theory, it's no different, but in execution, it is. First of all, you've got a presenter named Dan Jones, who is easy on the eyes, who wears a tight motorcycle jacket and is walking up and down the battlements, you know, and said, jacket, and he's got kind of a sexy underbite. So you put that aside. Got that going on. There are dramatic reenactments. There's a level of cheesiness to it, but it also has the cinematography is different. They put cameras on drones, so you can kind of go through the battlements and the crenellations and all this stuff, and you can actually see the structure of these castles from the air and move through them in a way that we haven't been able to do before. It's great. And the other thing is that the point of the series is that these structures last, which means that it's not just about how they were built and, you know, the swords and the shields of ancient history, but how these structures continue to intersect the history at different points over the centuries. So we learn something about Dover Castle, about its role in World War II. It's all about this this timeline. So I know it makes me feel 78 years old, but I'm going to say Secrets of Great British Castles.
Secrets of Great British
Castles.
It's
not lemonade. It's the opposite of lemonade. It's the unlemonade.
Is there
it's
any possibility?
It's the iced tea. It's a nice sweet tea.
All right. I'll take your word for it. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Danielle Henderson, what is making you happy this week?
I have been very happy about a book I'm reading, which I came to through way of a documentary. During a small bout of insomnia last week, I finally watched Everything is Copy.
Oh, yeah.
A documentary that Nora Ephron's son made about her life. And I was struck by how ubiquitous she has always seemed in my life. And then I realized I don't think I've actually ever read her work. I've read snippets, I've heard quotes, you know, she's always been omnipresent, but I've never sat down and really read her work from cover to cover or in one fell swoop. So I have the book, The Most of Nora Ephron, and I've been reading it and loving it. She has such a singular voice, and her kind of roughness is really smoothed over with these brilliant observations about modern boring aspects of life. And I just really appreciate being able to kind of access that and kind of understand her a little bit more through her actual work and her words. So The Most of Nora Ephron. And then that got me to something that seems maybe ridiculous, but totally fits in the scope of my life. I've started going back to the library.
Nice. We embrace that.
Yeah.
I went back to school when I was 30. I got my undergraduate degree and then my master's degree in rapid succession. So for years, I read nothing but dense texts. And it took me quite a long time to feel comfortable reading fiction again and reading short stories just for the fun of it, to not find the work of reading something that was more practical than the actual things I was reading. So I've been really enjoying the library. I love it. And I live in New York where I have access to tons of different branches. And I like going in and getting books and picking them up from different branches to kind of check out what those buildings are like. I don't mind paying the late fees if I'm late because
right.
It's a charming way to get to talk to librarians.
Right.
I've just been really jazzed by the library.
We, by the way,
targeting the demo.
I was going to say, I just want to point out, we did not tell her.
You are not antagonizing our listener base.
Introduce herself to our listener base by complimenting libraries and librarians, but it won't hurt.
Just real life.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Danielle Henderson. All right. Speaking of New York, making me happy this week, I was up there last week for a few days for a little taste of the Tribeca Film Festival. And Tribeca is still a kind of a smaller festival if you compare it to the big ones like Toronto and Sundance and stuff like that. But it is a really interesting fest that, you know, you still see some stuff that you wouldn't necessarily see other places. It's still a good chance to kind of put your eyes on some unusual stuff or some stuff that's just a little that you just don't know where else you might have encountered it. I saw the directorial debut of one Katie Holmes. I wouldn't necessarily call it a great movie, but it's interesting to see her kind of doing something different. She's also in the movie. But I want to spotlight really two very good films that I saw at that festival that I enjoyed a lot. One is a documentary called Bad Rap, which is about Asian rappers. And it engages with Asian rappers both musically and culturally. But it's a rich picture of these four people that it follows. It doesn't feel lectury. It doesn't feel kind of driven by an overarching thesis. it's just the stories of these particular people. There's a guy named Dumbfounded who has been around for a long time, came out of battle rap stuff. They also spend some time with a woman named Awkwafina, who kind of was received as a little bit of a novelty rapper when she first came out. She got written up in BuzzFeed and New York Magazine and some other places. She talks quite a bit about what she's trying to do. It's a really, really interesting documentary. I enjoyed it very much. I don't know for sure where you're going to be able to find it. The other one will probably be a little easier for you to eventually get your hands on, and that's Mike Birbiglia's new movie, which is called Don't Think Twice. And it's about an improv troupe, and it's, I think, very fair to what a group of people like that is like, in the sense that they're very close, they're very loving, and they don't hang around a lot with civilians, particularly when they're all together, probably because they'd be exhausting. And I think the film is very fair about that. The cast is really wonderful. It is it's him and Keegan-Michael Key and Gillian Jacobs, Chris Gethard, Kate Micucci from Garfunkel and Oates. And then also a woman named Tammy Sager, who you might know more of her writing than her acting. She has written for, this is a pretty impressive list, Girls and Inside Amy Schumer and Broad City, along with a bunch of other things. So she's done tons and tons of writing. She's very good in this movie also. And I enjoyed that movie a lot. It is a really sensitive look at what little groups of creative people are like and how their jealousies operate. Because, of course, into this happy little improv troupe comes the prospect of essentially Saturday Night Live, known in the movie as Weekend Live. But it's a pretty close copy in its visual iconography and stuff like that. The word I keep coming back to is fair. It's fair to this kind of person, in that I think it takes seriously their feelings about their creativity, but it also has this feeling of, are you going to try to go be on Saturday Night Live? And if you're not, what are you doing this for? And how long are you going to do it? And where are you trying to get to? And what is success? And for that reason, I think it gets into a lot of really interesting questions about creativity in general. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. Again, that is a Mike Birbiglia film called Don't Think Twice. The other one is a documentary called Bad Rap. And I saw both of those at Tribeca. So thanks to Tribeca. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Danielle at Naughty Yarn. That's Naughty Yarn. And you can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. Before we go, I also want to just thank Rund Abdelfatah, who has been helping us all through the month of April. As you know, we've been putting out the show a little early. That requires some extra hands, and they were hers. So we want to thank her for helping cut the show and for being an extra member of our team this month. We're grateful always. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Danielle, for making time for us from New York.
My pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.